Welcome to People More Interesting Than Me, the podcast, where I step back and let fascinating individuals take the spotlight. Join me as I sit down with incredible guests who captivate and inspire, showcasing their stories, experiences, and wisdom that make them truly extraordinary. Tune in for engaging conversations that'll leave you enlightened and entertained. I mean, at least I'm entertained. Today we have an episode that's close to the heart of our plant's fiery nature. Joining us are two remarkable individuals who play pivotal roles in ensuring the safety of communities amidst the volcanic landscape of Washington State. Our guests Elizabeth Westby and Brian Terbush offer a unique perspective on the dynamic interplay between science, technology, and proactive measures that shape our ability to monitor and prepare for volcanic activity. So without further ado, let's dive into the insightful conversation with Liz and Brian on volcano monitoring and preparedness in Washington State. Enjoy.
Like, it's so eye-opening. Like, I was like, what's the difference between magma and lava? Like, you always hear the two. And then I was just like, okay, let me look that up. And then, I don't know, all the numbers baffle me. Like, I didn't know there was like 170 active volcanoes in the U.S. I was just like, I didn't know that. And then you guys have like at least five near you guys. Is that right?
You're doing great.
Okay. In Washington,
yeah.
And then.
Yeah, there's 161 volcanoes, active and potentially active volcanoes in the U.S. and U.S. territory. So 161.
Okay. Well, today we have Brian Terbush. Am I saying that right?
Terbush, yes.
And we have Liz Westby. And you guys are the expert in Washington, correct? Am I getting that right?
Yeah, state of Washington. Yeah. And some of the experts.
Some of the experts. The many, but you guys are the best experts because you're on the show. That's how I'm going to phrase that. Starting with Liz, can you kind of explain what your role is?
I would be happy to explain my role. I work at the U.S. Geological Survey's Cascades Volcano Observatory. That's in Vancouver, Washington. And our job is to watch over the volcanoes of the Cascade Range. So that would be volcanoes in Washington State and Oregon. There's five in Washington, five in Oregon. We do volcano monitoring, so we can detect some of those earliest signs that a volcano might be reawakening. And part of what I do, a big chunk of what I do, is also talk to people in communities that could potentially be affected by an eruption. I want to make sure that they are aware of volcano hazards and they know what to do if a volcano were to suddenly reawaken. So I talk to the media. I do social media. I go out and do outreach K-12. I love talking with fourth graders. They are the wonderful group. And then I also social media. I work with Brian and emergency managers to make sure they also have information about the volcano. So really, it's we do a lot of work together. We've realized that in order to monitor these volcanoes, we work together as a group. It's not just us at the Volcano Observatory. It's much, much bigger than that.
Yeah, so Liz mentioned a lot of what I do, but hi, I'm Brian Terbush. I'm the Earthquake and Volcano Program Manager at Washington State's Emergency Management Division. So I like to think of emergency management as kind of the party planning for emergencies. If you had the time to prepare before an emergency and just think about all the things people are going to need during that time to keep it going, you got a party, maybe you need to bring more supplies in. You have an emergency, maybe you need more fire trucks, maybe you need more signage to help people evacuate. So when it comes to earthquakes and volcanoes, that's my focus for emergency management. So looking at our five active volcanoes, looking at our earthquake threat in Washington State, I'm thinking about all the things people are going to need to help them prepare for, to plan for, mitigate against the risks of these volcanoes. So a ton of overlap with Liz, making sure that people in communities understand, you know, realistically what a volcano is going to do when it erupts, what's going to happen when an earthquake happens, but most importantly, what they can do about it. Because a lot of people look at these huge mountains and think, oh, we're doomed if this happens. And that is not the case. Really, we want to help educate people and work really closely with Liz and the USGS Cascades Volcano Observatory to help people understand that. So,
oh, that's great. Thank you guys for both explaining that. And obviously, before we jumped on the episode, I was talking about all the, armchair like research I did. They show these simple questions, like, and obviously it's National Geographic or like Discovery Kids for me. And you like, we'll start off, and I know there's, as my extensive research, there's so many volcanoes around the world. Can you kind of break it down to like the threats of Washington only? That will kind of, like, I think a lot of people don't realize how many volcanoes are actually in the US and how many are actually active. That's the crazy thing. Like, there is no volcano class in school. That's the thing. The extent of volcanoes, and you know what I'm going to say, is the science fair with baking soda and vinegar. If you guys can give me like the rundown on at least Washington, what are the threats like? And if you can kind of explain, not the emergency preparedness, but what are some of the things that people need to look out for, but what are the threats that are kind of imminent when you start to get the signs of something that's happening?
As we mentioned, we have 5 active volcanoes in Washington, and we haven't seen them erupt in a while besides Mount St. Helens. Liz could probably talk a little bit more about what active means, but usually it's kind of, they've done something since the last ice age, about 10,000 years ago. Magma's been there, just add magma, these could erupt again. So those 5 active volcanoes, we have Mount Baker, we have Glacier Peak, Mount Rainier, Mount St. Helens, and Mount Adams. And all of these could start erupting at any time. And they're all a little bit different. They have their own eruptive personalities. If you look at the stories from the people that have lived here for thousands of years, they have names, they have characters. Mount Rainier is Tahoma, and it's, it reacts in different ways to the other volcanoes around it in these stories. They're really fascinating. So they all have different hazards that happen. Some are more explosive than others. We remember 1980 changed the world when Mount St. Helens erupted, but then it erupted again in 2004, and it just kind of built a dome. So every eruption is going to be a little different. I'd say the big thing we have to look out for here is a volcanic hazard called Lahars, which is a volcanic mud flow. So we all saw the ash from Mount St. Helens, but afterwards also some of those glacial blocks within the landslide that happened melted and just sent this stream of mud and trees and ash and rocks and all the debris it picked up along the way, miles, tens of miles downstream, taking everything out in its path. And all of our volcanoes have a lot of snow on them, and they can all do that too. So it's something we got to watch out for. And I'll switch over to
Liz. I'll add to that a little bit, Brian, because sometimes we also have the potential for explosive eruptions. Mount St. Helens, for example, you've probably seen the photos of the May 18th, 1980 eruption, that huge ash column that's going up into the sky and then moving off to the east. So there's also the potential for ash, for the explosive eruptions. And as you can imagine, when we have snowstorms here in the Pacific Northwest, traffic grinds to a halt, schools are shuttered. And so imagine what would happen if there was an eruption and even a light amount of ash falling in our communities. I think it has the potential to shut down the Pacific Northwest. Now, we're somewhat fortunate in the prevailing wind direction tends to be toward the east. So big communities like Seattle, west of I-5, they may not get the ash. It might be the communities east, but any amount of ash could potentially close airports, could affect transportation. So even small eruptions that produce some of these hazards that Brian was talking about, either a lahar that could impact infrastructure like bridges and roads, or ash that could put that could have ash falling on these communities, really has the potential to affect us in the Pacific Northwest. So even if you had an eruption, say at Mount St. Helens, and it was a small one within the crater, but if it produced these kinds of hazards, it really has the potential to affect people in a very broad way, in a broad geographical way. So that's kind of what we're looking at here in terms of volcano awareness and hazard awareness. It's just making sure that people aren't caught off guard when these types of things are going to happen, because they are going to happen. We've done some work in the past, and if you take a look at volcanoes and their eruptive histories, it seems like we have an eruption maybe 1 or 2 per century. And you're going to say, wait a minute, that, who cares? 1 or 2 per century. But if you think about it, I think it's kind of interesting. That means that people who, say, live in the Pacific Northwest until the ripe old age of 100 might be able to experience one or two eruptions. And certainly, if you are a planner for a city, for a community, you may need to know this to make appropriate planning decisions.
No, that was great. And that was definitely, because when I was looking into my research, it's also like timing. Like, a lot of people don't think about the timing, and they also don't think about it being in their backyard, because I didn't even actually look. I'm in Virginia, more specifically Northern Virginia. And I think I remember some tidbit in my brain that's like, there's a lot of, in the Appalachian Mountains, a lot of like, not, I don't know, it's not dormant. There's three phases: dormant, active, and extinct. Is that the...
Haven't really been volcanic in the Appalachians for a while.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like,
more like Jurassic funny period. That they're like,
let's go super, extinct, super okay?
extinct.
And I think just people are unaware, especially, I don't think they even know that a lot of volcanic activity is tied to earthquakes as well. And speaking on that, can you guys kind of talk on, not sensors, but kind of what are some of the things that you guys try to monitor? Just to kind of get a leg on any activity that's about to occur. What's that look like?
Well, we've realized that all volcanoes are a little bit different. When we say the volcano isn't erupting, it doesn't mean nothing is going on. It just means that they are all just plodding along at some background levels of activity. So we can see earthquakes. Mount St. Helens, for example, likes to have a lot of little earthquakes, little swarms. I think of it like Mount St. Helens is always talking to us. And it can all, some of these volcanoes can also have a little bit of deformation. Some of the volcanoes can have steaming and some thermal anomalies. So the idea behind our monitoring program is to put sensors out, to put seismometers, to put GPS out, to collect data and think about the history of the volcanoes, is to really get an idea about what they're all about and what does the background level look like for each particular volcano. So then when things change, we're going to be there. We're going to understand, there's an uptick in seismicity. What does this mean? Or we see an uptick in seismicity in gases, and now there's deformation. So that's the idea behind the monitoring program in the Cascade Range. When we haven't had an eruption since Mount St. Helens' eruption in 2004 to 2008, we want to make sure that we really have a good idea about the baseline. It's kind of like going to the doctor and just having your blood pressure taken and, you know, looking at your cholesterol, and it might be just fine, but really you're collecting baseline data so that they know when your health changes. It's the same thing for volcanoes. And that's why we have our sensors out. That's why we have this long-term monitoring program, and we're collecting data all of the time to figure out what is normal for each of these volcanoes. So we're there to be able to determine when things change.
Okay.
Yeah. Just to pop on that and add really quick, it's like, why are seismometers important for this? And the idea, I was just saying, a volcano, to make sure it's active, the idea is all you have to do is add magma, but that magma might be underground really deep, and there's a lot of pressure down there. So anytime that you're adding magma to a volcano where it moves far enough up in the crust that it can start erupting, it's going to have to break rock to get there. And that breaking rock creates small, certain types of earthquakes that can be detected, sometimes larger earthquakes, but that's why these seismometers that can sense the ground motion are so important. And I mean, geologists will argue about which is more important, seismometers or uplift or chemical signals, but really it's the better that's monitored, like Liz was saying, the doctor's visits. This is, you can tell what's normal and you can tell when it changes, and that's how you can alert people so that they know it's time to start preparing a little more.
And one thing I just had, I think I read from the IMA that you guys had done, is like, it's not, one volcano is not exactly like the other volcano. From what I saw, there's like numerous channels underneath, the position of where it's at geographically. It's kind of like, I don't know if this is like what you guys do, but the five volcanoes that are near you guys, I would imagine they all have personalities to you guys. Like, there's like the quiet one, there's the one who's always giving trouble, you know what I mean? But you get what I'm saying. Like, it's not just that they're mountain ranges, but, and it's just like if you had somebody come from like Hawaii and they were talking about their volcanoes, it's completely different from what you guys have to do. You guys know, probably you've seen the inside of these like numerous times, monitoring or something like that, or you know the seismic activity on a like a monthly basis. Like, you know, these are like, you guys are zoologists and you have five rhinos that you're monitoring. Is that kind of like that, or am I just completely off base?
Gonna start calling them rhinos.
Not off base at all. I always think of Mount St. Helens as a teenager, personally. I think, you know, she was just getting really tired of everyone. You know, there was 2.5 months of precursory activity leading up to the big May 18th, 1980 eruption. I think she, you know, Mount St. Helens was just getting a little fatigued with all of that attention, kind of blew the top. And then afterwards was very apologetic because there was a period of dome building within the crater from 1980 to 86. So I think that was one of those teenage outbursts that was followed by, oops, what did I do? And then, oh, let's make it better. Maybe no one will notice. We'll do this dome building. And then again in 2004 to 2008 was another period of like, okay, let's do it again. Let's do it again. Let's try and rebuild that huge gaping hole inside the crater of Mount St. Helens. So I think of Mount St. Helens as being very much a teenager. And the volcano is actually one of the youngest of the Cascade Range. It's one of the most active. And we consider it, because people are always asking, which volcano do you think will erupt next? And I'm going to say Mount St. Helens for those reasons.
Always changing. Just going through some changes, you know. Oh man, if I had to pick a personality for another one, that's a tough call, but I would leave it to the observatory since they're watching them a lot more closely.
No problem at all. What was I going to say on top of that? Is there any, just curious, is there anything like maybe the channels underneath Mount St. Helens? Is there any reasoning behind her having higher activity as opposed to the other five, since they're obviously, I mean, they're not all close together, but on a larger scale of the world, they're right next to each other. Is there anything like that?
So an interesting thing, and Liz might be able to add to this more, but you'll notice that our volcanoes kind of from north to south are mostly parallel, and that extends into Canada, into British Columbia, down into Oregon. The Cascade Range is there because of the Cascadia subduction zone, where the Juan de Fuca plate is being shoved under the North American plate that we all sit on. When it gets to a certain depth, it heats up. It starts to release some water from the minerals there that causes the mantle around it. It's not really molten in the mantle, but it, when you add this water, it causes it to melt. And then it gets buoyant. It rises up through the crust. And as it rises through the crust underneath us, you get these magma chambers developing. And because it's just moving at the same, because the plate is subducting parallel to our mountain range, that all happens at about the same depth. So you get this parallel line of volcanoes parallel to that subduction trench. However, Mount St. Helens, you'll notice, is a little bit offset from the other ones. And I know there were some studies recently, but I'm not super up on them. Liz, do you have another example of that?
Oh, sure. So Brian is talking about how magma is making its way into the crust, but it needs to make its way now to the surface. And so magma, I consider magma to be typically lazy. It's going to find the easiest pathway. And so what it tends to do is it follows crustal faults. There is something called the Mount St. Helens seismic zone. These are a series, a fairly big one, and then a series of little faults. So these are areas in the crust where magma is able to actually push its way up and erupt onto the surface. So Mount St. Helens is a little bit to the west of what you would expect for this Cascade Range volcanoes because of the Mount St. Helens seismic zone. So this is areas of the crust where magma is able to push its way up to the surface. Mount Rainier is also on a seismic zone. So we're thinking, you know, it might be the idea that we have these volcanoes where they're at because we don't have one long, huge volcano. We actually have different volcanic centers. And that might be related to how magma is able to move up into the crust and then how the crust, maybe there are faults and there are easier pathways. So magma is actually able to get to the surface and then start producing these volcanoes, some of which Mount Rainier, for example, 14,000 feet. So certainly you don't get to be that big by being stingy with your magmas.
Yeah, could be. You could even say that's the little sister or the older sister, not as rambunctious as her younger sister. I just wanted to touch back on kind of like the factors, and but kind of talk more on the technology. Obviously, you know, in the last like 5 or 10 years, everything has got more space agey. And I know you've mentioned, Brian, that like, especially with satellite imagery, that is another more evidence towards kind of monitoring, not just obviously the earthquakes with seismographs and stuff like that, but giving imagery on movement of, as you guys would say, not the crater, but what do you guys keep talking about? I've lost the word in my brain, that the volcano is producing the top of it. I've lost the word.
Sounds like you're just talking about ground deformation, though. Changes in the ground. You can see from space some of these big changes by using satellite imagery. It's really a fascinating idea. So a satellite passes over the ground. It takes an image. And then it'll do another loop around the planet. It'll come back around again at a particular time period, take another image of the same thing. And then there's computer technology that will allow you to put those two together and then make a difference pattern. So you can see if there have been any changes going on in that particular ground surface in that area. So you're able to see very broad periods or broad areas of deformation. We just recently did this in Hawaii. In Kilauea, there's been a dike intrusion south of the Kilauea caldera. You saw seismicity, you saw ground deformation, the GPS stations physically on the ground, you saw that they were lifting up for this intrusion, and there was this interferogram, which is essentially that computer processed image that shows you the differences, and that picked it up as well. So that's kind of interesting. That type of technology is fantastic for looking at really broad picture, broad examples of ground deformation. We still need the stations on the ground to get you some very specific stuff as to what's going on right there. But using this space tech, using these technologies for space really gives us a better idea about, say, the extent of an intrusion. An intrusion is simply magma that's coming up into the surface. It doesn't erupt. It's just kind of moving up into an area in the subsurface. And we saw that with a great precision most recently in Kilauea.
Okay. And is there any other new technologies that are being used to monitor or like I mentioned to Brian before you hopped on, like, I can't even imagine, like, using a drone, for example, to, like, obviously, you, and I said this jokingly before, but burn through them if they got too close, because they literally would be too hot, they'd burn, like, not, all those parts are not rated for that heat, that's obvious, or even probably 50 feet away from that, like, lava. So is there anything like that that's even being talked about, like drones or any other technology to help?
Oh, for sure. Like the people that I did my grad research with, they're constantly coming up with new ways to try to monitor volcanoes from drones, from different ways. And an interesting thought with that is you're talking about getting close to lava. But like our volcanoes in Washington, you're not going to get that close to really hot lava. A lot of the eruptions are going to be, well, if they're effusive, if they're just putting out lava, like the domes or lava flows that most of our volcanoes are made out of. It's a very different type of lava, much more viscous, much darker in color than you see, well, not darker in color than Hawaiian lava once it cools, but you see these like 15 mile an hour flows from Kilauea, whereas ours might move, you know, a few kilometers a day. They're not going to go very fast. It's just really sticky. Still very hot, still something you don't want to touch at all or get very close to, because the front can collapse while it's flowing, and that just leads to other hazards, pyroclastic flows. But yeah, you can get a lot closer to that with a drone without having to worry about, because it holds its heat a little bit better. So yeah, some of these things, I would say, I was talking before, we had a friend who was throwing a drone. Liz and I were both just in Guatemala for a conference, and they were at one of these active volcanoes down there, Volcán de Fuego, and flying their drone up close to it. And all of a sudden, like, there was an explosion on the volcano, because that's just what it does very frequently. And its proximity alarm is just going off over and over again, because there's all these ballistics flying at it at like 100 miles an hour or more, which is one of the reasons it's not a good idea to go near a volcano that's erupting like that. But the nice thing is you have this drone. It's an expensive piece of equipment that you you like, you spend time learning to use it, but it is not a human in this case, and you're not putting someone in danger to get that close. So there's a lot of applications here for people being able to better get close and monitor volcanoes without putting themselves in danger. So yeah, we see a lot of possibility there.
And
drones were great. A couple of years ago, drones were used. They created this little sniffer, gas sniffer. It's called a multi-gas, and they were able to make it small enough so that it would fit as a payload on a drone, because obviously drones are limited into how much they can carry. They made this small one, and they flew it up inside the crater of Mount St. Helens. They were looking for areas where gases might be escaping, and they wanted to know what kind. Was it a carbon dioxide? Was it a sulfur dioxide? Was it simply water? And so they were able to take this drone up there, and they did the survey over a couple of days. It was just like a lawnmower pattern. They went one way, they turned around, they came the other way. And it was a very efficient way to collect data, instead of having someone have to walk around and do the whole thing and collect it, which would have taken possibly weeks. So they used a drone in order to do this. So drones are a great new way to collect data in some of these remote areas, particularly like gas, where you can just fly the drone. Other things that we're starting to use is an infrasound. So if you can imagine, you see, you're looking at all the data, and you might see an earthquake come in, and you're really curious about what is going on. Is that really an earthquake? It seems to be at the surface. Could it be related to something else? We can use infrasound, and that will tell you if there have been disturbances in the atmosphere, because perhaps this earthquake is related to a snow avalanche or a rock fall or something on the surface. And so it really helps to, first of all, determine, you know, give you a better characteristic about what that earthquake is. And then you can maybe do a back azimuth and go, ah, we see where that occurred. Our infrasound is a 3-sensor array. And if we look, kind of figure out where the sound came from, we can figure out it came from very high up on the volcano flank. So therefore, it's most likely a snow avalanche, and it's not something necessarily related to increased volcanic activity. So we're doing that. And another big thing that we're just working with is AI, big data. You know, as you can imagine, with all of our new technologies, we are getting so much data. 6 gigabytes of data come into the Cascade Volcano Observatory on a daily basis. How are you going to parse through that? It would take a person, you know, forever. It would have to be their full-time job just to figure out what's new, what's changed, what's different. So we're working now with not necessarily AI, but just using the power of computers in order to make the first pass through that data. We can tell the computer, can you look for things that are maybe anomalous, that are outside the range of what we expect, and notify me when that occurs? And so I think that is one of the biggest uses of technology, is to be able to go back and take a look at all of that data and help point out to us the areas where we need to be paying more attention. Because it still takes a human to do these things. We can't rely on computers to predict eruptions and tell us what's going to happen next. It really takes not just one human, but actually a group of humans to talk about it, to bring their expertise to the table and figure out what's going to happen next. But certainly technologies can help us to maybe reduce the time that we need to figure things out, or that we need to mull over what's going on. Maybe that can reduce the time so we can warn communities. We can be more specific with our warnings. And so that's where we hope we're going with all of this technology, is to be able to give better warnings, more precise warnings, maybe geographic location warnings to communities who need this information.
Oh, that's great. And I mean, yeah, I work at a job where data is kind of, it's the same respect, where you have so much data, like, where do you even start going through it? And the issue is, by the time you look through the data, you have so much more data, and it might even be moot by the time you look at it. And it's just, you know, a needle in a haystack, and there might not even be a needle in there. That's the issue. So I mentioned my lack of knowledge on volcanoes, but since you guys work with emergency preparedness for volcanoes, earthquakes, and all that stuff, what are some of the common misconceptions people have of volcanoes and earthquakes? You seem like you have some fun ones already, Liz.
Oh, I'm just thinking of Yellowstone. Just, you know what? I guess, okay. So one of the things that people assume, and Brian kind of mentioned that a little bit earlier, people assume that the next eruption is going to be massive. It's going to destroy the entire West Coast, or it's going to be another Pompeii, you know, when communities were simply buried in ash. And so I think, and maybe Hollywood has kind of perpetuated that myth that every eruption is going to be a huge eruption, when really the most likely event is probably going to be a lava flow. At Yellowstone, for example, the most likely next event is not a huge caldera forming eruption like happened 631,000 years ago. It's more likely to be a small lava flow. And so that's one of the misconceptions that I feel like I'm always battling a little bit, is that people assume it's always going to be huge, that there may be nothing that they can do, the West Coast is going to be destroyed, and so why bother? And the reality is, it's probably going to be a small eruption, and it's probably going to affect you. Ash in the air can affect air travel. Lahars on the ground can affect infrastructure. Roads can be closed. Schools can be closed. So it's most likely you are going to be affected. And so what I would love to have people do is just to recognize the fact that volcanoes have different kinds of behaviors. There can be big eruptions, but most likely will be smaller eruptions, but you will be affected. You need to know what you're going to do if there is an eruption. You know, what do you do if your kids are at school? I mean, are you going to go get them? Is your school going to take them someplace? I mean, just think about these things in advance so that you're prepared. And I tell people, and Brian does the same thing, it's not just for volcanoes. If you have this real sense of preparedness, like, what am I going to do? Do I have preparedness, all sorts of things here at the house? Do I have food? Do I have water? Do I know where the kids should call? Do I know where they're going to be? If I'm prepared for a volcano, then I'm also prepared for a wildland fire, a snowstorm, a big earthquake. I mean, it's not like you have to prepare something special for volcanoes, but just understanding that there's going to be these events that occur on this planet. We live on a very dynamic planet. I think that's probably one of the biggest things to understand. First of all, volcanoes were here first. So they have been around for a very long time. We have observed some very large eruptions, some very small eruptions. And it's just, we need to figure out a way to live with the volcanoes that are here in our backyard. I mean, I know people will talk to me about, can't we drill down into magma chambers and maybe release pressure? Or can we divert lava? And I'm just saying, can't we just get out of the way? That's like the easiest thing that we can do. And it's probably where our technology is at the moment in order to deal with volcanoes. It's just like, when you're forecast activity, and then just simply get out of the way.
Yeah, good. Thank you for that. Just the idea that, if you're prepared for your volcanic hazards in your area, you should also be prepared for all your other ones that are going to happen much more frequently, your floods, your winter storms. These things that just happen seasonally now with fires and things. I would say my favorite misconception I've heard kind of combines my two areas of earthquake and volcano, because, we have this Cascadia subduction zone, magnitude 9.0 earthquake and tsunami off our coast. It's going to happen someday. It's happened before. And the question we get really frequently about that is that going to cause Mount Rainier, Mount Baker, one and or all of these volcanoes to erupt at once? And a lot of the things, if you're thinking about geology, is the past is the key to the present. You can learn from looking at these. You can learn from looking at other situations where similar things have happened. And more importantly, the past in this area. And again, our native tribes, the people who lived here, don't have stories about Thunderbird and Whale, which is their one about the tsunami and the earthquake back in 1700. But they don't have Thunderbird and Whale in Tahoma or Pato, or some of our volcanoes. They don't have this happening at the same time. The other thing, too, is if you look at like 2011, the Great Tohoku earthquake in Japan was devastating, but Japan has so many more volcanoes than we do, and it did not cause any of those to erupt. It's the same setting. 2004, Sumatra, Indonesia has even more volcanoes than Japan, did not cause any of those to erupt. So, like, is there a possibility? There's always a possibility, but when you're talking about these catastrophic events, it's really, really small chance, really, really small chance it's going to be even worse. But what I would always suggest to people is those plans Liz is talking about. What are you going to do in this situation? Make sure that your volcano plan would work after an earthquake. Just think about who you would communicate with. And if you have the supplies, if you're in the same place, can you still evacuate in the ways you would like to from home, work, or school? And can you still reunite with your family? And are your pets still taken care of? But just kind of think about those different hazards and make sure you're prepared. Even though it is the lowest case scenario, the least likely thing to happen, it's just understand that if you're prepared for one, you're prepared for multiple. Just think about them all.
Yeah, that makes complete sense. And I'm about to be a little bit nerdy. I was an Eagle Scout, and like there's so many things that went into that, like where you like there's an emergency preparedness badge, but like the key point to all that is being intentional, in my opinion, because you can say about all this stuff you're doing, but I know you can't do a dry run for a volcano, but you can, you know, like you can talk to your kids about it, like ask them, hey, what happens if, you know, like you go through A to D on all these different situations. I'm like, oh, I'll go to grandma's, or I'll stay with my family if that happens. Like, you know, like school shooting, tornado, earthquake, tsunami, like all these different things that can be kind of categorized in different plans of attack. And then obviously, I mean, you can walk through some of these, you know, like there's a fire in the house, for example, you walk out, but talking through with your kids and everybody else in the house, not even kids, but family members that are old and, you know, like they're at their friends playing pinochle or bridge or something like that. Like you stay there, but it makes complete sense. And I think being intentional about those things,
because I know a lot of people just like, you know, bat their eyes at stuff like that. But when it comes down to it, like, you know, you hear these stories about people who are actually like prepared for these moments, and it really those small periods of time that you're not prepared are the moments that are really critical.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate the nerdiness, but have to jump on something there just because, I mean, the idea you can't do a dry run. I mean, people are doing this. They are practicing. And one of our communities in Washington, well, a bunch of communities in Washington that are in the shadow of Mount Rainier, and its Lahar zone, especially the city of Orting, that's very close. They've been practicing evacuation drills for years. In case a Lahar comes, they have about 1 hour until it reaches their community, at least 9,000, 10,000 people living there. But what they've done every year is all of their students in the school practice their evacuation route. And what that has shown is that all those kids can get to safety in the amount of time they have, in an hour, which means everyone else can too. And they walk, they don't get in cars, they don't get in buses. They show that you can do this. And one thing we really struggle to get people to understand, but we want them to see that this is happening, is they can do it. These kindergartners can do this. You can too, but you need to practice. You need to understand these things so that if it most likely, the way things go, happens at 2 a.m. in the morning, you and your family are prepared, because something like a Lahar coming through, hey, it's going to destroy your property. There's not much chance you'll have something to come back to, but you can absolutely get out with your lives and what you have. And take have a go bag ready. It's the same for this Lahar situation, for a lava flow if you're in Hawaii, or but even like a really big flood coming through, or your house fire most likely to happen. Just thinking about these things and making sure that everybody's on the same page in your household. It really makes a huge difference if you practice.
No. Yeah. That is a cool fact. That is something that I did not know. And it makes complete sense. I mean, if you live near something like that, it would be crazy not to be prepared for that specific incident that could happen. Did you say 30 minutes?
Oh, they have about an hour. 60.
An hour.
Yeah. 60 minutes.
That's crazy. Wow.
But they, that's get like out in about 45.
Worst case scenario. Yeah. Worst case scenario. They have to be out maybe 50 minutes.
Yeah.
So yeah, and you know what I wanted to mention too, Brian, you know, it's not just like in our households, but actually agencies to agencies, we practice too. Like this afternoon, we happen to have practiced a call down, like what would happen if there was a sudden Lahar at Mount Rainier. And we were practicing, okay, what would we see? We would see, you know, maybe a big earthquake at Mount Rainier. We have monitoring stations in the valleys, these rivers that lead off of Mount Rainier. We would start to see them going down, you know, as this huge lahar, or this volcanic mud flow started taking out stations. We would then be notifying people about it. So we practice this afternoon, and it's not just USGS. We practice with Brian at Emergency Management Division. We practice with the county, we practice with South Sound 911. Okay, who's going to call who? Let's make sure that we do this as efficiently as possible, because as we said, if Ording, the town of Ording, only has 50 minutes to an hour to get out, we can't be the ones to go, I don't know, who do we call? So we actually did a practice today where we practiced calling everyone, made sure, like, at what time, you know, when did we first determine this was going on? When did we confirm it? And then making sure that we're calling everyone, because it's a huge team effort in order to respond to one of these things. It's not just the, you know, the science aspect of it, what's going on at the volcano, but it's also alerts and notifications. It's also very local evacuations and people doing their own thing too. So it's a very big group. When this happens, and it may happen, certainly it takes a lot of people to be part of this, and it's really amazing to work with these. I love working with Brian and the other people, very committed people to making sure that their communities are safe. I'm impressed.
Yeah, it sounds like a logistical storm. Like, I can't even imagine. Like, when you were saying call all these people, what I thought of is, like, I don't know what it was when I was a kid, but it was like a tree. Like, these five people need to call these people. And then it just kept on going and going and going. And I'm like, oh man, I can't. Obviously, it's probably much more technical now, but like.
Not much more than you would think.
Yeah, just, not much more.
Because the other thing is, it
takes,
like,
a person. It takes a person to confirm what's going on, and then it takes a person, you know, you have some questions. And so, yeah, and really it's a call down to say, hey, we're going to jump on a Teams platform, or we're going to jump on some kind of a communal platform to talk about this. So it's a quick notification, but we just have to make sure everybody is in the loop here and that we're all going to get on that joint communication platform so we can talk about next steps and what's going on.
Well, yeah, that's pretty essential, because I mean, if you obviously get the alert and you call it, you got to hurry up and have that meeting, because, you know, if it happens, and it obviously probably an hour is like one of the quickest reaction type deals, but I mean, time is of the essence. So looking towards the future of studying, understanding volcanoes and the relationship of earthquakes and volcanoes, where do you guys see the future of it going? Like, even technology, or even even reaction times, or anything like that in the future? It's a pretty open-ended question, but basically the future of volcanoes.
Ooh, Brian, wouldn't it be wonderful to have like a volcano early alert system? Something like you have for earthquakes?
It'd be interesting, but I mean, so if we look at like Mount Rainier and St. Helens, two of like the probably most monitored volcanoes on the planet, how much more warning could we get? I'd love to see that on all of them, just to know, like, as soon as it starts doing something unusual, we can start planning how we're going to keep people safe. But yeah, I think at that point, it's just making sure they're all monitored. But yeah, whatever we could do. I think the goal here is not, it's so hard to actually predict what a volcano is going to do when it erupts. All you can really do is forecast. There's a good chance it'll do this, but it might do this. And but the earlier you can start doing that, and the more data you have, the better. So yeah, monitoring is going to be so key to that. Just make sure we have all the information when we start making decisions for people's life safety.
And we're always going to have people in that equation too, because even with technologies, as Brian mentioned, you know, we can maybe get those signals earlier, or we can provide an alert earlier. You're still going to have people in this equation. And I think that's why Brian and I still continue to do what we do. We realize that we're going to continue to educate people. We need to do this because there are always going to be people that need to know what's going on. We need to provide them with actionable information, not just tell them, oh, the volcano is doing this, but tell them what they need to do, how they can plan for it. And so that's, I don't know, maybe it's job security, I don't know, but there is always going to be that somewhat unpredictable component, which is people. How do we get people out? How do we talk to people about hazards? How do we talk to kids about hazards? How do we talk to skeptics about hazards? And so I feel like, you know, technology is advancing, and I'm fascinated by the way it's going, how we're able to collect more data, we're able to be more specific, but there is always that last piece, which is the people piece. How do we make sure the people are aware of what's going on and they know what to do? And that is probably the most challenging. You talk about technologies, but really it's human nature that is still going to keep challenging us. And I don't know if there's a technological way around that. I just think it's continuing to be like these human to human interactions and going to meetings and talking to people about it. I don't know if technology can get us out of this. I think it's a person to person interaction.
Yeah, because one of the most important things I feel like that we do when we work together for the education of people is just getting them to understand what the hazard is. Because the faster we can get that messaging, that's great. You get an alert on your phone that says there's a lahar. But what does that mean? And we want people to understand what that means so they know how to react, and that, hey, if you want to be safe, you got to get to high ground and understand that on a level that is more than just an alert. It's the government telling you to evacuate, because we want them to understand this is for their safety. That's you got to really understand that, and that takes more than technology can provide. So if you got any keys, we're happy. We're eager to
hear. I actually thought of a really good one. So okay. You know how they have all those, I don't know what the Apple VR thing is, and you can kind of see, like, you can see your kitchen, but you can also see the recipe. You can see what's going on, stuff like that, and timers. You have a lahar coming down in your backyard, and it simulates what it would actually look like. And it would give you suggestions on how to, in this case, you'd want to, you know, like stuff like that, just so they can actually see kind of the impact of what it would look like to their house. Obviously, it's not going to, a lahar is not, well, I don't know that. It's not going to come underneath their house and sweep it away, but it's one of those crazy ideas.
No, that sounds fantastic. I think putting people in the situation where they can understand the hazard is great.
And you could even, I mean, you could even do that with, you don't not have to be so interactive with your house. You could just have a VR simulation of what it would look like, and kind of walk in the eyes of the person of, you'd have to generate a lahar digitally, not like from real life, because you're not going to have this person, you know, have a body cam on doing a simulation of this lahar. Speaking of crazy questions, I thought of a crazy question that's super crazy. Obviously, everyone's looking for power that's not going to generate CO2 emissions and all this stuff like that. And I heard some crazy story that people in El Salvador are using geothermal power. Has that ever been a thought for Mount St. Helens to ever kind of use the heat from the volcano to produce power for Washington? Or is that crazy, like I said?
Well, it's not crazy at all. Actually, that's down in California. They have geothermal plants, so it's not crazy at all. They did try a geothermal plant in Newberry. It has to be an area where there's a fairly high heat rising up into kind of the upper crust where you can reach it by, and usually typically what they will do is inject water down there and heat up the water and have the water come back as steam to drive turbines, and then that will generate electricity. So that is done in a number of places around the world. There are geothermal plants, but it has to be pretty specific. You have to have some good conditions there in order to have that. Mount St. Helens just doesn't have quite enough heat in order to put out enough megawatts to make it worthwhile to have a geothermal plant up there. Really, all of our Cascades are pretty cool, at least in the upper part of the, you know, near the edifice where you would want to have your geothermal plants. And so not to mention the fact that some of them are in national parks, some of them are in a wilderness area. So good luck with that geothermal application.
Good luck with the monitoring permits.
Yeah. Okay, that was my last
last volcano question. So we come to my last question, and obviously you guys can take your time to think about this. What is something that your parents did that you'd like to pass on to a next generation? And what is something that you might do a little differently? And this does not need to be, like I said, volcano related. This is specific to you guys. I asked everybody this on the interview.
All right,
Yeah,
I
I can
can
start with what my
go ahead.
parents did that I really appreciated, and it is volcano related. So, when I was growing up, I was born and raised here in the Pacific Northwest. And so for me, volcanoes were an amazing place to go and visit. We went camping, we went hiking. They took us on, mom and dad took our family. There was five of us kids. So we were a fairly big family. So we did a lot of camping adventures because that was inexpensive and a way to keep all the kids happy. So we did a lot of backpacking. We did canoe trips. We did bicycle trips. And looking back on it, I feel like that was very impactful on my life because when you're doing these trips, first of all, you're enjoying the nature, you're enjoying the beauty, you're learning to appreciate the out of doors. And also you're learning that self-reliance and that confidence, especially if you're backpacking, you're age 10, 11, 12, you're going with your family, you have whatever you need on your back. I feel like they really taught me how things may go wrong, but you can deal with it. I felt like, because nothing things always go wrong whenever you're on a trip, but I just felt like they taught me resilience, they taught me confidence, they taught me troubleshooting. I feel like that has really served me well, not just in my career, but actually in going through life. So that's one of the things I want to say. Thank you, mom and dad. They were probably just thinking it was a fun thing to do with the kids, but I really feel like that was very important, and that was a great thing to pass on. And it's a great thing to pass along to all kids to make sure that they have opportunities to go out into the out of doors. I do a GeoGirls program at Mount St. Helens every year. We take 20 middle schoolers up to Mount St. Helens. We do some hiking. We set up installations with seismometers and GPS. We show them what it's like to work in the field, hopefully to inspire them to become scientists themselves. They already have that interest, but at age 13, 14, 15, they're not sure if it's for them. So we bring them up there. And so that's kind of my way of maybe paying back mom and dad for the opportunities that they gave me as a kid for going outdoors, as I try and provide these opportunities for middle school girls here in Washington and Oregon to give them that same opportunity that I was given by my parents.
It's nice.
Yeah, that is super nice. And I'm going to start on a very similar level to that. I was also extremely fortunate to have parents that brought me outside all the time, though it was in New York, so a little bit different. But our mountains are a little bit smaller, but they're still mountains. Don't let anybody tell you otherwise. So we had those. I spent a lot of time out there, and I even went through a little phase like Mount St. Helens, the way Liz was talking about it, where I didn't really know what I wanted in teenage years and didn't really enjoy going outside with my parents. But you know what they kept doing? They kept dragging me outside until I enjoyed it. So I would recommend, and also huge thank you to them for that, because it takes a little while to realize it sometimes just how important our outdoor areas are. And that included dragging me to Mount St. Helens in the year 2004 and climb up that one. That was quite a hike. But yeah, that was what really got me into this field, just seeing that and how amazing that landscape is and all of the volcanic landscapes around here. Just wanted to learn about it and learn about that and how it can impact the world and how we can help protect people from that. So huge thank you to that. Drag your kids outside until they enjoy it, if that's important. Or until they can make their own decision about whether they enjoy it or not is probably a better way to put it. But
I like it. Either way, drag them out or just keep on.
yeah.
Tell them where the food is. It's outside. You can come outside. No, I like that. And I totally agree with that. I feel like nowadays, makes me sound old nowadays, like you just need to throw the electronics somewhere in a lockbox and then just kick them outside.
Absolutely.
I don't mean kick them in like a physical way, more like a, yeah. But no, I definitely agree. I like that, guys. Actually, I think that might be a new one. I love, I think I mentioned this to you guys, like mental health is a big one that's expressed on here, but you could even tie that with being outside, because, you know, with like electronic social media, all this stuff, like being outside is like the exact opposite of all that. It's like you're listening to nature. You're listening to the seismics on the ground as well, if you want to tie that into volcano. You're feeling the earth. No, that's a good message. Do you guys have anything else? Because we have obviously not volcano month. It's earthquake and tsunami month next, or in April, is that right? Am I getting it wrong?
So May is
May,
Volcano
Volcano
Awareness Month.
Awareness
May is, well,
Month. Hey,
in
we do it at the
Washington.
same time.
In
Right?
Washington.
3, 2, 1. May
May
is
is Volcano
Volcano
Awareness
Awareness
Month
Month.
in Washington.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Oh,
Is
that
there any
was really
reasoning behind that?
Well, on May 18th in 1980,
There you go.
Washington had a pretty famous eruption,
There you
so
go.
we commemorate that.
Do you guys have any volcano parades?
I mean, we do have
No.
the volcano evacuation drill.
Oh, that's nice.
That's sort of like a volcano parade.
Oh, little
That's
volcano
so
hats.
nerdy, Brian. That's so nerdy to do. That's our volcano parade, is our evacuation drill. That's so
Oh,
nerdy.
yeah. I'm proud.
But is there anything else you guys want to message before we close on up?
I would say if you ever want to learn more about the volcanoes in the United States, Liz probably has some good recommendations for you at the USGS Volcano Observatory. But I would say on our end, hey, like we've talked a lot about preparedness, I'm an emergency manager. I know it's not a very well-known career path or anything like that. But if you want to learn the preparedness tips for your area, look up your city, look up your county emergency management agency, or your state if you can't find those, because there are tips specific to your area, how you can get prepared. And we talk volcanoes and earthquakes, but whatever you have in your area, you might have snowstorms or hurricanes or floods or anything like that. If you want some tips, just look to that in your local area. And there are things you can do to prepare for any of these things, even if they seem huge. You have the power over these. So just take some time to think about it.
Right. This is all about lifelong learning. So if you're curious, if you're passionate, follow that passion, follow that curiosity. You never know where it's going to lead you.
Absolutely.
That's great. Thanks, Liz and Brian. You guys are great. I mean, just like every episode, I learned so much, and fall on my face a couple of times trying to regurgitate stuff that I had read online. So that's even better.
You did excellent.
Yeah, it's great.
But thanks again. I appreciate you guys taking your time out. I know that this is after 5 o'clock too, but you guys love to talk volcanoes and emergency preparedness. So that's even better, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah,
Yeah.
thank you for having us.
Yeah, no problem.
Yeah, thank you very much, Michael.
No problem. Have a great night, guys.
You as well. Thank you.
If you like this week's episode of People More Interesting Than Me, please follow me on Apple Podcasts so you won't miss out on more episodes like these.